I'm not saying that golf's important or anything like that. It ranks right up there. But anyway, what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to talk to you about the experiences of three servicemen, one sailor, one Marine, and one soldier. This past summer, I read a book called The Loss of Sadness, and it's written by Alan Hurwitz and Jerome Wakefield. It's a good book. It's not a biblical counseling book, but you should get it and read it. And the subtitle is How Psychiatry Turned Normal Sadness into Depressive Disorder. And it's probably worth it just for the title, but you should get it and read it. It is actually at the center of a growing controversy that exists today with regard to the treatment of depression in the United States. And I'll tell you a little bit more about it as we go forward. But there was one part of it that applies to what I'm going to talk about now, and it was their account of what happened to men when they went into war during World War II. World War II was different than what we're doing today with our soldiers. Today, our soldiers are deployed for anywhere from 12 to 15 months. Sailors, maybe 6 months. During World War II, when my uncles went off to war, they left, and they came back when it was over. And they were there for years. And the reason was there wasn't any good way to get back. There still isn't. You know, you have to fly by jet. But at that time, there was no good way to get back. And besides that, there wasn't any coming back. We were there to fight to the end because our freedom depended on it. Men went off to World War II, and they may have had leaves, but there really wasn't any place much for them to go. Post-traumatic stress disorder back then was called battle fatigue, and it's interesting to what we're talking about tonight in that the psychiatrists and physicians who took care of soldiers at the time noted that 70% of them, if you kept them in combat continuously for any prolonged period of time, 70% of them would have some sort of mental breakdown. One report estimated that the average soldier would have a psychiatric breakdown after 88 days of combat, and that after 260 days of continuous combat, 95% of soldiers would break down. It was treated much differently than it is today. Back then, they would take them off the field of battle for 48 hours. They would get a shower, they would get to sleep, and they would get fed, basically. And they were told that within 48 hours, they would return to their unit. And within 48 hours, two-thirds of them did, with no more care than a meal and a hot shower and some sleep. Out of World War II and that experience came the concept that all of us can be broken. In the 1950s psychiatric maxim that all of us have our breaking point. That was where it came from. And it really shouldn't surprise us that most men and women, if subjected to the horrors of war for a long enough period of time, will be affected by it. Now, I'm going to leave the reading of the definitions that are in your notes about post-traumatic stress disorder to you. You can read that. I'll read this one. A psychiatric disorder that can occur following the experience or witnessing of life-threatening events such as military combat, natural disasters, terrorist incidents, serious accidents, or serious personal assaults like rape. I'm going to leave the DSM-IV criteria to your perusal because it'll take up all our time and we really won't get to talk about what I want to talk about. So let me skip through this. And this is where I want to be. I talked to three servicemen. One was a Marine in Vietnam. The second was a soldier who served in Iraq for 15 months. And the third was a sailor who served on the USS Roosevelt during the Cuban Missile Crisis. The sailor came from Chillicothe, Ohio. I don't know whoever back there who came. You're Chillicothe? Who's from Chillicothe? You guys were from Chillicothe, yes. Yeah, that Charles Perry, he was from Chillicothe. He was the sailor. Now, my goal is a lot like what the Apostle Paul said in his letter to the Corinthians when he said that I like the King James Version of it, be followers of me as I am of Christ. I didn't pick these three men to talk to them about post-traumatic stress disorder because they were in trouble. I went to talk to them because I knew them, and I knew that they had been through a lot, and they had gotten out on the other side and were doing well. What I went and basically did was I sat down and talked to them for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours about what had happened and what they, and the things that I was really interested in were things that didn't help and things that did. You know, I always say that before you go out and help people, you ought to really make sure that you are. You know, sometimes we do lots of things for folks that we mean well, but they really don't help them very much. And so I thought, well, I should talk to these fellows and see what helped them. So let's start with the Marine in Vietnam. He turned 19 in the middle of a valley in Vietnam that probably would look to us sort of like what the gates of hell might be. He joined the Marines, and if there are how many service men and women are here? You've served. All right. So did you serve in the... Tell me where you served, would you?
Vietnam.
Okay. Were you Army, Marine, or...
Army.
All right. And
I went to Thailand.
You went to Thailand. With the Army or the Marines or the...
Air Force.
And somebody over here?
I'm still waiting to go.
You're still waiting to go. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you for your service. You all don't get thanked enough for it. Now, the reason why I asked that was because the Marine, and this is with apologies to the soldier, he said he joined the Marines because he thought they might train him well enough that he might survive. That was his rationale, so forgive me, but that's what he said. The one day in battle was absolutely riveted into his attention. That was, they were in a firefight, and a plane came over that was doing a close air support, and it was a prop plane. And as it came over, something fell off the plane, and it was just like the scene in We Were Soldiers, but young. They thought that the guy had dropped a canister of napalm on them, and when it hit, it turned out to be an empty rocket canister. And it certainly riveted that day into his life. He thought he and his friends were going to be incinerated. During the course of the 18 months that he served in Vietnam, he was wounded twice. And on June the 3rd, 1967, he was hit by shrapnel. And then in September of that year, he was on an armored personnel carrier that had a lot of gasoline in it. And it was hit by a rocket and blew up, and he was burned. And he spent a good bit of time in a hospital in Japan recovering from his injuries. I think he got two Purple Hearts out of it because he got shot twice. But that wasn't as important to him as the fact that once you had been wounded twice in Vietnam, you didn't have to go back. You know, once you were shot twice, you could opt not to return. And he did opt not to go back. He didn't encounter post-traumatic stress disorder until he left the service in 1969. As long as he was in the Marines, he had something to do, and the structure that the service gave him supported him. He did tell me that he did have a little trouble when he had a 30-day leave in the middle of his Vietnam deployment-type experience, and he came back home to Connersville, Indiana, which is a small farm community, and there wasn't anything to do. I mean, there was nobody there because his siblings were in school, his mom and dad were working, so he literally was at home alone. And he said it was a lot like being a trained killer with absolutely nothing to do but time on your hands. And he said the thing that saved him was that he had a friend who was a farmer who needed about 1,200 acres plowed. And so for that 30 days, that's what he did. He went out and plowed a field all that period of time, and it kept him, busy. He said of his training, it was a very good thing. And I think that's probably what you need to focus in on a bit. The training, I think, is what begins post-traumatic stress disorder. We train people to do things, and then they keep on. You know, it becomes part of their being. And as my friend said, that if they hadn't have trained him that way, there had been a lot of days when he was in Vietnam that he would have simply been dead. He didn't return to Vietnam after his second injury. He went to the Mediterranean, and he ended up training soldiers in other countries. And he really didn't have any trouble to speak of until he left the service. The soldier who went to Iraq, the soldiers' experience in Iraq were different because the war was different. And I think he got there about the time at the start of the surge. He would also argue with the Marine about training. He led men into firefights on a daily basis, but I think the thing that weighed on him most were the IEDs. They were in the middle of a people who were glad that our men had come, but would really have been glad if our men were gone, and so it still is today. In March of 2008, the Humvee that was ahead of his hit an IED, and when the men ran up to help the men in the first one, they set off a second one and killed 9 men that day. After that, it really changed that soldier forever. After that patrol, every civilian became a very real and potential threat. He couldn't sleep. His ability to make decisions slowed. He would say that he simply lost his edge. He struggled with being physically ill and vomiting. He did go see the doctor, and they did try to help him with medicine to sleep. He talked with the chaplain, and while that helped the most, nothing really made a lot of difference to him. Like the soldiers in World War II, he came off the duty line for a time and eventually returned to patrols, but the confidence that his training had given him was gone. Those events happened towards the end of his deployment, and he'd been in for 9 years at that time, and he decided not to go back. He did not re-enlist. He had 2 small children by then, and he didn't want to be gone every other year. That was how it was going to be. You know, he would come home, be home a year, and then he would be redeployed for another year. My sailor friend, who is a dear friend of mine, his service was on the USS Roosevelt as an aircraft mechanic, and he was required to fly off ship in fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters, and he was deployed in the Caribbean during when Nikita Khrushchev and John Kennedy squared off over the nuclear missiles in Cuba. And he had several things that stuck with him out of his time on a carrier. Aircraft carriers are very dangerous places to be. And they were maybe even a little more, it's hard to say if they're more dangerous then than now, but they had a lot of propeller planes still. And, you know, the danger was is that you had ear protectors on so that at least you were supposed to, so that you wouldn't be deafened. And so you couldn't hear what was going on around you, and there was always the potential to walk into a whirling propeller. And in fact, on one day, he watched a friend step into a prop, and he and about 5 other guys were just splashed with this guy's blood. Says to this day that if you took a squirt gun and shot him in the face, he would see it again. Poof. You know, when the stuff hits his face, you know, like our mister or anything like that, he would see the face again. He would see it all over again. A second one was watching a pilot who was probably the most respected pilot on the aircraft carrier. They called him Panel Puss. That was his handle, and the reason why was because he had a couple of wrecks before, and his face had hit the control panel, and he had some scars on his face, and so everybody called him that. And he didn't mind. It was a term of endearment for that matter. But on that day, on a catapult takeoff, the landing gear collapsed as he was being shot off the deck. And, the plane was not going off the deck, and he ejected, and everybody was cheering because he ejected, got high enough, and his chute opened, and it looked like he'd done it again. You know, this guy was famous for, you know, almost getting killed for several times, and until he drifted off the edge of the boat, and when he hit the water, he got tangled up in the cords of his parachute, and he drowned. And my friend watched that, said there wasn't a thing he could do about it. said he could have jumped in with him and they would have both drowned. And on another day, he watched a five-crew bomber take off, off the deck. He was supposed to fly on it, but a friend of his had asked him to let him fly on it instead because he needed to get his flight time in for his flight pay. And that plane crashed and killed everybody on board. And my friend saw it, and he was supposed to be on the plane. One of the other memorable ones was when he was standing, he was working on a machine on the deck, and the they were unloading the guns on a fighter, and they were 50 caliber gun bullets or whatever, cannon, whatever. And they had these belts, and the belts were 9 yards long. And he says that's where the phrase, "I gave them all 9 yards," came from, you know, all 9 yards worth of bullets. And evidently the mechanic had to be up underneath, had to flip something, and then the whoever was in the cockpit would pull the trigger, and the belt would fall out. Well, whatever happened wasn't that, because my friend was standing there, and suddenly along both sides of him, either side, were 50 caliber bullets flying, you know, down both sides of him, going down the deck. Fortunately, nobody was hurt, but they, you know, let off the trigger and the bullets quit flying. But my friend said that he then turned and went back and talked to them for a moment about it. And he said he used every Anglo-Saxon malapropism he could to describe what he thought about it. Those are cuss words. Anyway, he wasn't a Christian at the time. Okay, those are the three. Now, what's their description of post-traumatic stress disorder? The soldier who went to Vietnam, the connecting factor for him, and or rather the Marine who went to Vietnam, pardon me, and then the soldier was insomnia, the thing that bothered them the most. Remarkably, for both the soldier and the Marine, they neither really struggled with dreams about it. Never was much of an issue, but going to sleep was a big issue. The Marine attempted to solve this problem by drinking. And drinking became a serious problem, a complicating problem to his situation. Hypervigilance was a big deal for my friend. He slept with a loaded gun underneath his bed for 5 years. He was highly reactive to perceived threats, any noise that sounded like a gun. His sister once tried to play a joke on him and jump out from behind a corner and frighten him. And he said before he kind of realized what was going on, he had her up against the wall with his elbow in her throat, and then told her that maybe she shouldn't do that again, as if she probably wouldn't have gotten that idea. He did go hunting once, he said, went hunting for rabbits, and after the war, said he was in the field with his shotgun, was walking down a field when another hunter came out of the woods and shot a rabbit. And he said, before he realized it, he was down on one knee and had a bead on the guy. And he came to himself, you know, before he shot and unloaded his gun, and never has been hunting since. Didn't think it was safe for him to do that. He also, I think, went home and took the gun out from underneath his bed. Hold on here a second. Okay. Yes, all right. Now I know where I'm at. He still keeps the shotgun underneath his bed, but he keeps the bullets in another place. I've never understood that. I mean, I understand it, you know, why you wouldn't want to keep the bullets with it, because you're afraid you'll make a mistake and shoot somebody. But it's sort of like, what are you going to do when the burglar comes? Are you going to ask him to wait while you go get the bullets? I suppose then you could probably give him ear protectors. Here, put these in, because I'm going to shoot you, and I don't want the bang to hurt your hearing. Isolation was a real problem for the Marine. He said when he came home, again, as we said earlier, that there was really nobody there. His friends had sort of moved on, and our country had gotten to what I consider a most disgraceful place in our national history when our soldiers who returned were either ignored or protested against. When, as I interviewed my friend, I thanked him for his years of service to our country, as is my custom, and he said that he thinks that people do it a lot more today because they sort of feel guilty for the way the guys from Vietnam were treated, and I really do think that that's likely true. The fact that no one greeted him when he came home and no one seemed to care about him made his situation somewhat worse. My friend denied that he had any problems with anger, although he allowed he was easily provoked. I don't know what the difference is between that and anger. But anyway, he said a couple times, when he was in college, and I think a second time when he was in the dining hall, a Canadian student made the unfortunate mistake of saying something about the war in Vietnam. And he said before he realized that everybody was staring at him because he was talking a mile a minute and rather loudly, and he had invited the Canadian guy to move back to Canada. I did see a glimmer of guilt at one point. The Marine told a story about a young Vietnamese boy who did things around the base, and he had lost an arm. He was missing an arm. And my friend said he was missing an arm because we. And he stopped at that point. And then he said, because of the war. And I asked him about that, and he said, yeah, he did feel in part responsible for the civilians who died and were wounded just because they were in the way. The trained killer aspect, he said that over and over again. I think that's very important because I think a lot of what we see in PTSD is simply what we trained these men and women to do. And we shouldn't be surprised if they would continue to react in the same way. And it's also important because I think what we teach people, we can also, whatever can be learned can be unlearned. Now, the soldier, that was the sailor, no, that was the Marine, the soldier. The common thread for the soldier and the Marine included the insomnia. The soldier couldn't sleep. Nothing the Army could do could help. And that may be born out of the hypervigilance thing. You know, that's part of post-traumatic stress disorder. And then again, it's really hard to go to sleep with mortar shells going on around you. You know, when you hear the incoming, it calls your brain and your body to do things. The soldier came off patrol for a while, as they did in World War II, but his response to it was that studs don't break, and he was broken. His inability to make focused and timely decisions were a great loss to him. That was the thing that he was trained for and the thing that he was good at, and it was gone. He told me he had lost his ability to fill the role of a soldier, and that's what he believed he was called to fill. And he lost his purpose and the thing that defined him. While he was off patrol, it really just sort of made things worse because he ended up being isolated by the very nature of the process. Everybody else was out on patrol. He was back at the base. And there really wasn't much of a support structure in the fray for him. The bottom line of it is he saw himself as broken, and the Marine said that as well. Part of them was broken and it couldn't be fixed. Now, my sailor friend, he described PTSD as something that he lives with to this day, and he'll be 70 in July. But he says it's something that does not affect how he lives. He still sees the man walk into the prop every once in a while, and the image is just as vivid as it was on the day it happened, but the emotions that are attached to it have long since faded. He doesn't struggle with insomnia, but he, unlike the other two, he did have nightmares for a time. I don't think he has them now, but he says he has daymares. You know, he'll catch himself daydreaming about it every once in a while. I asked him about anger, and he said early on it was a significant problem to him because he was angry at God for allowing these other men to suffer and die. And at the time of the events, he was not a believer. He described hypervigilance as one of the main expressions of the problem in his life. He was constantly trying to avoid walking into the next propeller or being shot by somebody accidentally shooting off the nose cannons. Now, how did they respond to all this? What did they do? Well, my Marine friend responded to his loss of structure and purpose and the isolation after he left the service by drinking himself drunk most every night. That was how he would get to sleep. He would just drink until he passed out. He was never offered any, and he did not ask for, any help from the Marine Corps or the Veterans Administration. It never occurred to him. The soldier, did talk with the doctor and the chaplain, and it went to at least one group session. He refused to go back after that one because he thought he was surrounded by people whose complaints were minor compared to what his buddies had suffered. And I think it just made him angry to be there. He left the service. Fortunately for him, when he came home, there was a support group waiting for him. Came home to a wife and two daughters. His wife had been active service as well. They were part of the reason why I chose not to re-enlist. To this day, veterans and memorial days are really hard for him. My sailor never really talked with anyone about post-traumatic stress disorder until 1988. And that would have been like 25 years after the events. And it was when he was in a doctor of ministries program for counseling, and he was required to go talk to a therapist for 12 weeks, for an hour a week, and so they talked about post-traumatic stress disorder. The first solution to turning PTSD into something that would that he would have for the rest of his life but would not determine how he lived came in a helicopter. He was out on a patrol looking for Russian submarines. History is just a fascinating thing at times. They were dropping nuclear depth charges back then. They were dropping small nuclear bombs into the Gulf of Mexico. And the reason why they were dropping them was because a conventional depth charge could not bust the hull of a Russian nuclear sub. You know, it would just bounce off of it and wouldn't cause them any trouble. So they manufactured nuclear depth charges, which would vaporize the Russian sub where it was. And the reason why was because we were playing this game with the Russians of chicken, which their subs going up and down our coast and our missiles located around the world and our planes flying. And it was the MAD strategy, the mutually assured destruction. The reason why we wouldn't shoot at each other too much was because we knew that we could destroy each other. So they were out patrolling in the Caribbean or in the Gulf around Cuba, and they were about 70 miles from Key West, where they were based, and about 40 miles from Havana, from the Cuban coast. And the Charles said that a thin stream of hydraulic fluid at about 3,000 pounds per square inch, it came out of a line, went across the inside of the helicopter, went into an electrical box on the other side of the helicopter, and set the helicopter on fire. If he'd have passed through that thin pencil-like stream, it would have cut him in half. That's how much force and pressure was behind it. The problem, he got the fire out. The problem was is that it emptied their main hydraulics, and the helicopter became uncontrollable, and they thought they were going to have to ditch. And they didn't want to do that. There were sharks, and then there were Russians and Cubans, and they didn't want to fall into the hands of any of them. But ditching a helicopter is a really complicated thing at sea, and you know you're liable to be killed by your own blade. Because when it hits the water, it would evidently turn into shrapnel, Charles said. And so the pilot got on and said, look, we're probably going to have to ditch. Guys, get ready to go. And he was preparing to do that when he got back on the radio and said, look, I have control of this thing right now. Sit down. We're going to try to make it back in. And he leaned it forward, which is the fastest way. Evidently, you can fly one. I wouldn't know, but that's what Charles told me. And they flew that way straight back to back to Key West. And when they got there, they landed it just like an airplane because it couldn't hover. And when they got there and he got out of the, when he and the pilot got out, he climbed up the side of the thing, flipped open the hatch, and there was no hydraulic fluid in it, period. There wasn't any in the backup and there wasn't any in the main. And both he and the pilot had concluded that they had gotten there by a miracle. Well, my friend Charles, even though he was unsaved at the time, when he was back in the back and it looked like they were going to have to ditch, my friend Charles started praying. I think he'd probably been to church at least three times in his life. And it wasn't like the usual, dear God, save me and I'll quit cussing, drinking, chasing women, lying, cheating, and I'll tithe. It wasn't one of those kind of prayers, although it was close. He said he did pray and he asked God to save him and save the crew. And he said if he would, that he would go to church on Sunday and he would listen. I thought that was pretty good. You guys, are you still awake out there yet? You know, if it looks like you're going to fall asleep, stand up or something. It won't bother me a bit. But anyway, so he did. He went to church that Sunday morning. And when the church that he and his wife Martha went to it was a missionary church, and it was a Spanish national pastor, and he had a service in English and a service in Spanish. Of course, Charles and his wife went to the English service, and he said that in the middle of that service, he listened to the pastor preach the gospel, and he accepted Christ as his Savior. And that was the beginning of his cure from post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll have more to say about that in a minute. Now, what were the issues when they got home? Already, we've noted that the Marine had his problems with hypervigilance and loud noises, and his drinking was his main problem. The Iraqi soldier, his triggers were the smells of the city, sewage, trash, people, and he was somewhat irritable. I know what he's talking about when you walk by something and smell it and you're suddenly someplace else. There are a lot of places in the country now that are priding themselves on the idea that their toilets don't use water. You know what I'm talking about, the waterless toilets. Well, the problem is that as they have reduced the amount of water that goes through toilets to zero in some cases or half what it was, what they forgot was that the city's sewer systems and most of the plumbing in a lot of the old buildings were designed to work based on the idea that you flush the toilet with a significant amount of water. And some buildings around the country, the urine actually has corroded through the pipes, you know, because it just sits in the pipes is what happens. Well, in some major towns like San Francisco, you know what parts of San Francisco smell like now? Sewage. That's right. You walk by a drain on a storm sewer, and it smells like an outhouse. And the reason is because the sewers don't flush. Well, my son says every time he walks by something like that, like he was in Chicago, and he said, I walked by a sewer, and he said, bang, man, I'm back in Iraq, because it's the same smell. So those kind of things bothered him. I suspect that irritability was a problem to him, but the main problem he described was finding a purpose. He had defined himself as a soldier, and that purpose was gone, and he had to find something else. My friend, the sailor, only talked about his hypervigilance and anger with God and about his nightmares. Now, what didn't help? All right, what didn't help? Well, for the Marine from Vietnam, the military offered no help. Drinking really didn't help. Isolation didn't help. No work, which when he came back from the Marines, he didn't have a job. And no goal and a lack of purpose did not help. For the soldier, medication, group sessions, physicians, healthcare professionals, isolation, none of those things helped. The thing that one thing that I didn't expect that kind of struck me was that he said he didn't like to hear people talk about just war theory in theology. You know, for those of you who preach, it wasn't that he minded having people pray for the guys out in the field and stuff like that. He just didn't want to hear sermons about the war. I suppose it's a lot like, you know, having something happen to you and then seeing about it on television, and you reach over and grab the control and you flick it. You know, I'm not going to live through that again. And I'll change the channel. Let's see. All right. So then, what did help? All right, what helped? Well, my friend who was in Vietnam, his dad helped. On a given day after my friend was back home and was sitting around doing nothing all day and drinking himself into a stupor at night, his dad came up and sat him down and said, "You're going to get a job. No, I have a job for you. You can't sit around like this anymore." And he got him a job managing newspaper delivery. He didn't deliver the papers. He managed the people who did. His father had fought in World War II and had driven a tank for a Patton and had gotten a Purple Heart getting his tank blown up or something like that as well. His dad understood. His dad had seen this before. His dad knew what his son was going through. The next thing that helped was divine providence. Yeah, divine providence. My friend continued to drink, and on a given night, he was racing. Him and about five other carloads of young men, all drinking, all drunk, were out on a square, you know, a bunch of county road square, gravel road, mile on one side, half mile on the ends, and they were racing. And that was working really well until he lost control of the car and hit something that didn't move. He probably should have been killed, but he wasn't. And nobody else was badly hurt. I think he was the only one that ended up in the hospital. And they called in his family doctor, who was an older guy, and this was in the early 70s. And the old doc walked in. It was like 3 or 4 in the morning, and he looks at my friend and says, "Have you been drinking?" And my friend said, "Well, yeah." And so he proceeded to scrub up and clean up all his wounds and sew them all up, except he didn't numb him up. Yeah, I don't think I could do that today. Somehow I think I'd get sued over it, but back then it seemed appropriate. You know, therapy was combined with retribution. To the old doc's credit, when my friend went off to Bible college, he did his college physical for him, and when he was done, he said, "Well, I'm going to hold this bill, and if you graduate, you don't have to pay it. But if you don't graduate, you have to come back and pay me." Well, anyway, so the old guy cleaned him up, scrubbed him up, fixed him up, and then put him in a hospital bed. And, of course, my friend woke up the next morning with a hangover and just feeling awful and could not get out of bed because he was, you know, too badly beaten up. And this was before HIPAA and before private rooms and things like that. And there was an old guy who was in the hospital, was on the other side of the room. And what woke woke him up was that the old guy turned the radio on and turned on John Rawlings. John Rawlings at the time was big on the Cincinnati radio station and was at the Landmark Baptist Temple, Baptist preacher of the last generation. And the old guy had it up kind of loud, and my friend looks over and says, "Could you please turn that off?" And the old guy looks at him and says, "Can you get out of bed?" And my friend said, "No." And so the old guy got up and pushed the table that the radio was sitting on closer to him and just out of his reach, and then he turned it up. And my friend said that Rawlings was preaching about having gifts from God and not using them. Said he remembers that sermon very well to this day. My friend said that he was saved at the age of 8 and had spent most of that time between those two points running from God. So, divine providence. From there, the Marine's life was a series of events in which God's divine providence kept opening similar doors and kicking him on through. He said he started going to church, listening to the sermon, studying his Bible. Studying his Bible actually played a big part in dealing with his problem, particularly when he found Paul in Philippians chapter 3 and read that part about forgetting the things which are behind and looking ahead to the things, looking toward the things that are ahead. Christian service and a new purpose in life played a big part. He quit drinking and eventually quit smoking because the music guy wouldn't let him be singing the quartet unless he quit smoking. All that eventually led to Bible college and a lifetime of service to Christ as a minister of music. And now his son is in Afghanistan. We both agreed that it would have been a lot easier to go ourselves than to watch our kids go off and do it. He still sleeps with a shotgun underneath his bed, but it's not loaded. He still reacted to loud noises. None of it decided how he was going to live. And I would think that he said that God's grace decided that. All right, that's the sailor, the soldier, or rather that was the Marine, the soldier. I would say that the soldier is still processing the issues associated with post-traumatic stress, but doing well. The things that made the greatest difference in his life was when he had a wife and two kids to come home to, and was surrounded by friends who were aware that, of what he might be dealing with. And I would say that they listened a lot. That was a big thing. The thing that helped him the most was, as he related, was finding a new purpose in life and a new sense of worth, because he had left his in Iraq. He couldn't be a soldier anymore, and he moved into business. And the leadership skills that he had learned in the Army became the basis of his new identity, and he had friends who were aimed to help him when he got home. He found a church and a small group that was most helpful as he transitioned from Army to civilian life. I think it was important to him that he recognized that part of him was broken and he couldn't fix it. And instead of trying to spend the rest of his life fixing it, he would move forward. That was pretty much what the Marine and the sailor both said. Life was never going to be the same. They had given up something for our benefit. Now, the sailor, and I call this the sailor and the sovereignty of God. And I really think that if you want to ask me where the final solution to things like post-traumatic stress disorder are for any group of people, it does fall out into the sovereignty of God and understanding how that doctrine and how God impacts the events that go on around us on a day in and day out basis. The sailor said that after the propeller incident, the five guys who were standing around when it happened all sat down and talked about it. He said that helped a little, but no one tried to come up with a solution, except there was a general agreement amongst them that their fellow had not been careful enough and that they would be. I think the thing that made it, and that's probably the source of his hypervigilance too, that and the other things that almost happened to him. The thing that made it bearable for him came after he was saved, and it's kind of a remarkable story. He was on a training mission in which they were dropping buoys, which were really practice drops for nuclear depth charges. Yeah, that was how they were going to hold the Russians off. And he said that they would drop them, and then they would come back, and there was a frog man down in the water, and they would let a line down, and he would hook it, and they would bring it, you know, haul it back up into the helicopter. He said that it was on a given day, and he said he had been studying his Bible, and he had come across Hebrews 9:27, and it says, "It's appointed unto man once to die, and after that the judgment." And he said it was almost like God was talking to him. He said, I looked down in the water and I saw that frogman. It was just like I was looking at Panopus again. And he said, it was like God was telling me it was his time. It was okay. It was his time. as he talked about that, I could see that the sadness was still there, but the anger and I think the guilt that he carried was gone. He said, of his experiences, "I didn't let it," meaning the flashbacks, "alter my life." After he became a Christian, he was called to ministry. And he said, from that point on, he said, "Whatever God was going to allow to happen to me would be good for me and would give him glory." He said he had a drill that he did whenever he would see the flashback. And whenever he saw it, he would say, "Lord, you're in control." And then he would say, "Perfect love casts out fear." And then he would say, "This vision will not hurt me." And he did that for years. And he said once he started doing that, the flashbacks diminished. He said he still would see the vivid picture, but the feelings associated with it diminished. It didn't diminish quickly. I don't think anybody quickly arrives at a conclusion to this. And I don't think there's anything that we can do to quickly deliver people to it. It's a lot like the Marine searched in the Bible until he found Philippians 3 all by himself. All right, now, what are the things that help them? What can we do? Well, I would tell you, we can listen. And we can help them find others who've shared their experience and will listen. The Marine said that the Marine actually probably talked to me more about that period of time in his life than he'd ever talked to anybody in most of the years since the war. He said he would not talk to just anybody about it. If he was going to talk about it, it would be more likely that he would talk to another soldier who had been on the field. I can tell you this, that I do not understand what being in combat is like. I've never been there, and most of us haven't. And the Marine told me that the people that he thought would have the best opportunity to help those who've been there would be, or help those who've come back would be people who have been there. That doesn't mean that all the rest of us can't, but they do have a leg up on us in the process. I can tell you this about it. It's hard for me as a doctor not to want to get to the part quickly where I help people in a prescriptive way. You know, my prescription pad and pen are always at the ready. But I really like what Rick Horn says about talking to angry teenagers in the book called Out of My Face. He says that in order to help angry teens, that we must listen big, which means, and first and foremost, listening long and actively. That means that as we're listening to the soldier or the person who's the struggler, we shouldn't be sitting there listening, trying to figure out what the answer to what we're going to say next. You know, instead of formulating an answer to whatever they're saying, we just really need to be attending very carefully to what they're trying to tell us. Listening to people who are storing anger and fear and guilt isn't an end to itself, but it's a place to start. And you have to start someplace. And I can tell you this, that the church will always have a corner on free listening. You know, that's the business that we're in. The rest of the world is out there trying to figure out how to fund it, and we can do it for free. All right. The important things that that the men told me were all connected to finding their way back into society, into a meaningful, productive life. The soldier and the Marine both spoke of finding a purpose, and the soldier was very specific about it. When he found meaningful work, his situation started to improve. The Marine, when his father figured out what was going on and forced him to get a job, that helped him. Helping the returning veteran find work is always going to be something that we should be about. The sailor made it obvious that finding Christ will always be the door to real recovery when it comes to the problems of post-traumatic stress disorder. Moving on here just a sec. Salvation will always be essential to any long-lasting permanent change. You know, it says very plainly that if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things pass away and new things are coming. So permanent change has to come through salvation. A return to normal life, as normal as can be ordered, will always help. All of the following things reduce isolation for the veteran, and that is one thing that they do want to avoid. Church. While they may personally want to hide, we need to direct them not to forsake the assembly. They need it because God commands it, but they need it because there are people there who care about them and want to support them. It's true for people who are depressed. It's true for people who are sick. I always tell folks when they tell me that they can't go to church because they don't feel good, I always smile and say, well, are you contagious? You know, because if you have something contagious, maybe you should stay home. But, you know, if you're not contagious and you're chronically sick, you're better off in church, you know, because you can be miserable sitting at home in bed or sitting at home on a couch, or you can be miserable in a pew. And the difference is that if you're in the pew, you're going to be surrounded by people who care about you and who want to help you. So Christians... church is important. Christian service. I always encourage regular service for people who struggle emotionally, for whatever reason, for depression or anything, and I tell them that it has to be for someone who's worse off than they are, who cannot pay them back, from whom they take nothing, and it can't be for a relative. I always tell folks that there's always secondary gain to be had by doing something for your mother-in-law. It needs to be for somebody that you're not related to. The reason why I say that you should do that with almost all your counselees who are struggling emotionally is because it takes their focus off of themselves, yeah, and onto somebody else. They need to get the family moving back into the family to resume the role that God has appointed them to is essential. Both the service person and the spouse need to understand that this isn't going to be a light switch phenomena. You know, the young soldier who comes back to his wife and children, and his wife's been pretty much managing things by herself for a year, they both need to know that he needs to be back in the spot where he needs to be as head of his household, but that somebody else has been running it while he's been gone, and they're kind of used to running it. And it's going to take a little bit of adjusting on both sides in order to get the job done. But it needs to happen. The wife needs to move into her role. If it's a service woman returning, as is the case today, again, a mother who's been out in the field with her husband back at home taking care of children, husband needs to help facilitate her return to the role of a wife and mother. After that, we as families need to really encourage our servicemen and women to understand that we're going to be their best encouragers and supporters in the world. And friends need to look up the friend who served and encourage them. We have a duty to do that. Other things that help are a Bible study that is directed toward the grace and sovereignty and nature of God. I think that affected the sailor the most. When he chose to believe that God was sovereign in the life of Panopus, that was when his life changed. When he could say that I believe that God knew what was best for Panopus and he knows what's best for me, then my friend started to improve. As he said, it was the man's time. He also chose not to allow the flashbacks to decide where his life would go. And that's a matter of grace. You know, we always need to remember what Ephesians 2, 8, and 10 tells us. It says, for we are saved by grace and through faith, and that not of yourselves. It's the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. I'm always amazed at believers. I think it must be what Paul felt like when he wrote to the Galatians. People who realize fully that they are saved by faith and through grace, who then figure that they have to live the Christian life on their own. You know, that it will be an effort by works from that point forward. Well, that's not the case at all. It wasn't the case for my friend. God empowers us by his grace to make the changes in our lives that we need to make. It's good to remember, in working with individuals who struggle with this, that it took Job 42 chapters. It did. It took him 42 chapters to get to the idea that God is all powerful and he can do as he pleases. That is the conclusion of it. I always smile and say that it's like, yikes, you know, it only took Paul 4 chapters to tell us about rejoicing and in the Lord. It took Job 42 chapters to get to the point. And as I look at people who are struggling, I would tell you that everybody has to live their own 42 chapters. You know, it's like there's no way to rush this. You can look at Joseph in the Old Testament as well, and you know it. He made that famous statement when he said, you meant it for evil and God meant it for good. And we look at that, and you know, it's the precursor of Romans 8, 28 and 29 in the New Testament. And I would tell you this, Joseph didn't say that on the day they beat him up and threw him in the pit and sold him into slavery. I don't know what he said on that day, but it was another 25 or 30 years before he got around to the point that he looked him in the eye, the guys who sold him into slavery and threw him in the pit, and said, "You meant it for evil, and God meant it for good." So it takes people time to work through this, and we should be willing to give them that time and support them as they work through the process. It's important to understand what is broken and allow them to accept that. There's never going to be a day in the life of these three men that I talked to that they're going to be the same as they were before they stepped onto the field of battle and experienced the reality of it. They're different as a result. And they can either use that difference or they can become victimized by it. It's one or the other. You get the choice. We need to help them deal with aspects and their behavior that can and must change over time through progressive sanctification. Folks who have post-traumatic stress disorder and will always have other problems that will make things worse for them, like anger, fear, focus on self, guilt, living in the past, being too distracted to serve God, substance abuse, all those things are going to be issues. And they need something to do at the time they have those flashbacks. I really like the sailor's drill. Let's see, what was that? You might want to write that down. He would say, "Lord, you're in control. Perfect love casts out fear." That's 1 John 4:18. "And this vision will not hurt me." And he said that every time he saw it. All right, then it's Philippians chapter 3 that my friend found. It said, "Brethren, I do not regard myself as having laid hold of it yet, but one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press toward the goal, the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus." That was the passage that made the most difference to the Marine. There was one story he told me that sort of summed it up for him. When he left Vietnam for the last time, he flew out on a C-1, I think it's a C-130, all by himself. He was the only person on the plane beside the pilots. And evidently there was a window in the back, and he went up and asked the pilot if he could stand in the back and look out that window as they took off. Now, you know pilots. I mean, I flew in here today, and, you know, I mean, if it gets just a little bit bumpy or they're going up and down, it doesn't make any difference if your eyeballs are yellow and your bladder is about to explode. They want you, what? Buckled in. Yeah, they want you buckled in. And so the pilot looked at this guy, and he said, "Well, why do you want to do that?" And he said, "I just want to watch Vietnam get smaller and smaller and disappear." And the pilot said he could. Let him go back and do it. My brother once sat with a guy who was struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, sat with him in a rusted-out car body on the back of his property while he was sitting there drunk, holding a gun, threatening to shoot himself with it. My brother would never do this again because at one point the guy pointed the gun at him and pulled the trigger. There wasn't a round in the chamber. That guy was, I think, just playing with him. And eventually, the guy killed himself. And my brother went to our friend, that was my brother was his college roommate, and he asked him, why didn't that happen to you? And my friend's response was that he said, "I just decided to move on. I just decided I wasn't going to spend the rest of my life back there." All right, that's what I learned from those three servicemen. Now, what questions do you have about this, about post-traumatic stress disorder? Yes.
The incident that just happened in Afghanistan with the shooting, what is your thought on that? Could that have been post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, exposure maybe serving time before going back, checking the door? What's your thought on that?
You know, I thought I might have to answer that question tonight. I was driving down the road thinking about that because I've read of the accounts as you have. And, You know, the first and most intelligent response is we really don't know what happened. We don't know what had happened to him or why he chose to do this. I like what Ed Welch says. I was listening to him talk about bipolar mania. And he said, it was an interesting statement that he'd made because I'd never heard anybody else make it. And that he said that a mania does not cause people to sin. You know, the Bible strictly says that mania does not cause people to sin. And I would tell you that post-traumatic stress disorder does not cause a U.S. soldier to shoot 15 civilians. Did combat change that young man, and did something happen that set him off to do something which was not what he was ordered to do? The answer is yes, it certainly did. But beyond that, it'd be difficult to speculate because we don't know what the facts of the matter are. Other questions?
Would you develop further? You said you can either use what you've been through or be victimized by it. Can you give us some thoughts on how to use it instead of being victimized?
Well, you know, probably the best example of someone who used it as opposed to being victimized by it is the Old Testament figure Joseph. Whenever I have people who come in and they've had really bad things happen to them, I can remember talking to a fellow, and he had been abused throughout his childhood by step-parent and step-siblings that was grotesque at best and demonic at worst. And it affected pretty much the rest of his life up until the point that I was talking to him. And I can remember relating to him and sending him to read about Joseph. And the reason why I send people to look at Joseph is because it's my contention that there isn't anything that can happen to us in life that didn't happen to him. You know, you think about it. You know, you're lied about, you're hated in your family, you are, they threaten to kill you, they throw you in a pit, they sell you into slavery, you are sexually harassed, thrown into prison, and forgotten. And you can look at that and say that all those experiences should have turned Joseph into a bitter, angry, vengeful person. And instead, it just made Joseph into the prime minister of Egypt and a servant of God. And the difference between being the victim in Joseph's case was that at every turn, no matter what happened, he always chose to serve the Lord. You know, that was his response to Potiphar's wife. How can I sin against God and my master? I mean, all kinds of people today could figure out how that wasn't such a bad thing. Think about it. I mean, we live in a society where the biggest argument in the last 2 weeks has been over a 35-year-old law student demanding that we pay for her birth control so she can live fornicating. You think about it. I mean, that was the whole of the argument on the radio, and she is being made out to be Joan of Arc, and we're supposed to be tolerant. I mean, you know, it's like my mother, when she saw that, said that in, you know, 1950, no woman in her right mind would have gotten up and said that she was doing anything like that, period. You know, we live in a society which would literally approve Joseph committing adultery with his boss's wife and wouldn't think a thing of it today. And it would have destroyed Joseph's life. You know, Joseph could have made himself out to be the victim, justified his sin because of his anger, and then spent the rest of his life reaping the whirlwind. And instead, he chose to serve God, suffered, you know, in short term, and then did well. My Marine friend, he could have spent the rest of his life on the wrong end of a bottle of Jack Daniels, and he would be dead now. You know, I mean, at the rate he was drinking, he would have died. But when the choice finally presented itself, rather abruptly by God's grace, he chose instead of being a victim, he chose to serve. So I guess that's how I would look at that. Other questions? Any other questions? Well, then it's break time.